That is local radio. You have to know where you are. I felt as if there were some barriers there with certain individuals. The chart show for me was a bit like a bug in a rug.
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which we talk to those who made a difference. Bruno Brooks.
I was born to Les and Sheila Brooks, and I was born in 1959. My earliest memories were from time to time going to my grandma and granddad's house, and they were from a very, very poor background. Literally, the kids would go out and shoot rabbits with 22 air rifles, bring them back, gut them, and hang them in the kitchen on a washing line. So that gives you some idea of the Brooks background. My dad, he of the many brothers and two sisters in the family, he was the entrepreneur, I suppose, and felt that he was to get his own business, and he opened a car wash, and effectively that's what he did all of his life. He's still with us, and it was only a couple of years ago that he sold his last car wash, but it would be fair to say that he was the finest scrubber in the world. You know, I mean, his service levels were insanely good. He never failed in car washing. He did actually go into property lets in Florida and made a few quid in that as well. But other than that, you know, the Brooks family were pretty poor. His hard labour in the earlier years did allow me the chance to go to a small private school called Woolstanson Prep. And he was very disappointed when I failed my 11 plus. I never went to high school and then ended up working in the car wash until I was, you know, sort of 14, 15, 16 part-time whenever he wanted me. But that's really where the real turning point was, albeit I got into music and I loved listening to Tony Blackburn as early as 14 years old.
OK, then 23 and a quarter minutes past five.
This is Radio 1, big news in life.
From the big city.
Big city.
In other words, Scunthorpe. Right then, here's another one that I think is an absolute knockout. Playing it as a chart-bound sound. Good play it as a
I was forever told off for listening to Radio Luxembourg through the night and not getting to sleep, and therefore it's affected my schooling. Stuart Henry had so much presence for me. I remember I'm 14, 15. You know, I'm a teenager, and yet he seemed to be considerably older.
Number one in Britain, but over in America, the new number one is this record. Number one, Carly Simon.
You walked into the park.
He had a little glint in his eye, a sense of humour, a vibrant personality that you couldn't forget once you'd heard him. You'd want to know who this human being was. Bob Stewart I also liked because, of course, in the 70s, there was a lot of influence coming through from the United States in music and also in radio presentation.
Broadcasting on 208 metres in the medium wave, 1440 kilohertz AM, with a power of 1.3 million watts. This is the English service of Radio Luxembourg. Our programmes commence in
But all of them, Tony Prince, I used to love. I loved his royal rural approach. Peter Powell was great, and it didn't take me much to work out that actually he was the one that was attracting the girls, and, you know, he had these relationships with the pop stars that appeared like that. And Radio Luxembourg was an amazing radio station. The only thing it wasn't very good about it was its transmitter. We put up with all of that. I mean, for hours on end, the squiggles and the squirts and the whatever. It was the fact that it was far away, or it appeared to be far away, that also made it special. You know, they were magical years for me. In my own time, I wasn't really a big fan of television. I was much more of a big fan of music and that connection between people playing that music and me, the listener. And it wasn't long after when I said to my dad, I'd like a pair of double decks, I want to have a go at this. Like anything, it never comes when you want it. But eventually I managed to persuade him. He bought me a pair of second-hand disco double decks. They cost £70 at the time, which is quite a lot of money, even though they were second-hand. They didn't work correctly, and then I wanted to start to understand how it all worked, and I took the back off and electrocuted myself, which was a silly thing to do. And I think my dad obviously knew what my passion was. The idea was to go and sort of advertise my services at kids' birthday parties and weddings, In fact, I still have the first receipt I gave when I was 15 years old for £5, written out by my dad, a receipt for £5. And that really was the start of the journey. My dad, the entrepreneur, could see that there was something here. Everywhere I went, I always had a fantastic response, to the extent that the next job that came in was Jolly's, they were number one cabaret club in Europe for many, many years, and they were based in Stoke-on-Trent. They actually asked me if I would go and play music in the breaks between the acts on this revolving DJ dock on almost a railway that went from the side of the stage to the front of the stage. And even then I was still only probably 16, 17 years of age. And I remember a guy who was dancing on the dance floor in his suit with his wife, once saying, "This guy will get to Radio 1 one day." I overheard what he said, and I thought, that's great. Wow, someone's recognised something. I felt good. I felt as if that was truly the start of a longer journey, but a good journey, because that's exactly the sort of thing any sportsman would want if they were younger, or musician, or whatever, artist. When somebody that you trusted and somebody so senior would make a comment like that to his wife, and his wife nods her head whilst they're dancing, was something I never forgot. Certain things do stick because it had that kind of value. So it was really time in the area where I became a very famous person, because not only was my career locally allowing my father, for instance, to be able to hire big town halls, and I mean big town halls like the King's Hall and Soap, to promote Bruno's discos. And by then we'd bought equipment from Genesis, a whole tour set from Mud, and a number of other bands, and we had one hell of a stage show. So therefore it became quite a big business for my dad. I was still on a couple of quid a week. But then I think that it got to a stage where Radio Stoke kind of knew this was part of the Stoke teen infrastructure. And somebody must have said at the BBC, "Look, we should really have a teenage show, shouldn't we? I mean, we should be doing something." Eventually, they said, "Well, we won't give you your own show, but maybe you'd like to go and do some interviews with all the bands that turn up at the Victoria Hall in Stoke." And we had every single band turn up. And that period was the punk period. And so I found myself actually going to interview bands, from Billy Idol to Jimmy Percy to... And then there were rock bands like Scorpions. I was the last person, for example, to interview Bon Scott before he died. But for me, I didn't play any of this music. So I had to learn something new. I got into something that I wasn't doing elsewhere. And these interviews were being played out on the breakfast show at Radio Stoke. So it was promoting a kind of more of a journalistic approach to what I was doing. And then soon after, they said, "Well, look, why don't we do this teenage thing?" And it was called Bruno's 435 Express.
What were your ambitions like at this time? I mean, you were obviously finding it difficult to practice the way you wanted
to. We didn't have any ambitions, really.
You formed the band, didn't you, Andy?
No, well, yeah? Me and Vince did, yeah.
And it was originally two guitars and one synth, I think, yeah, or you had guitars, right, yeah, involved. And Dave, you went to another
and
school.
And it was recorded and then very soon live. And then I got a call one day from a guy called John Getgood, who I got on very well with at Radio Stoke. He was a producer, quite senior. He said, "Bruno, our afternoon presenter, unfortunately, is not very well. He can't travel from Wolverhampton, where he lives. Would you like to come and do the afternoon show?" Now, this was a big deal for me. This was all new. I had to run with it. I thought, well, I'm going to do it my way. And I remember Jeff Lawrence, the boss, literally, and he and I didn't get on that well, because there was also somebody there called Sandra Chalmers, who was like the station chief. And we know Sandra is the sister of Judith. And she was much more of a support. But Jeff came running in with about 60 requests for people who wanted to mention on the program. And these were people, the families, and the kids who'd been coming to these discos, see me at the cabaret club, see me at somebody's wedding. You know, I was visible in the area, not just a journo that come in and was doing a show. And all of a sudden, they could suddenly see that there was more traction here and there was probably a bigger play. So let's see how it goes. I don't know what it is, but the individuals then were very similar people than the individuals that you see now in BBC Local Radio. They are journalistic, they've got good degrees probably, they know the area sometimes, and they go out and they do reports with a kind of microphone and some kind of digital device now, as opposed to a ewer. They do what they do. And let's face it, BBC Local Radio is not that dissimilar from what it's always been. It has a job to do, it's a service for the community. But that's not my upbringing. I was sort of a DJ. I was somebody that came up through yelling at crowds every night. So it was an environment I had to get used to quite quickly. But I was lucky because this show was turning into something that everybody was talking about. It was far removed from the normal, which was almost too nice, too informative, a little bit too structured. And we know what that is, and it's not me being horrible, a BBC Local Radio format. And that's the reason why it changed so rapidly. Listeners went through the roof. I brought a lot of comedy into the and telephone interaction. And also my local knowledge went a long way. So typical scenario would be, right, who's on the line? It's Dorothy, darling. Yeah, hi, Dorothy, how are you doing? Where are you? I'm in Blurton. Blurton, whereabouts in Blurton? I'm in Smithson Street. Whereabouts in Smithson Street? What do you want to know which number? Well, just give me a clue. Are you near the Smithson pub? I'm three doors away. Are you the green door, the red door, or the blue door? I'm the blue door. I know exactly where you are. What do you want now? That's the approach. That is imperative. And for me, that is local radio. You have to know where you are. It's all about the audience. It still is. And it's all about the audience and everything I've done. And it's all about the audience and everything I do now. I run lots of channels for major corporations around the world. I have to know the culture of their audience and why they buy into that brand. Who are they? It's no different. There are many people in BBC local radio stations over the years, people like Billy Butler and all these guys, that knew their audience. And that's why they were so big. And I sometimes think, and I listen to BBC local radio along the years, and obviously it has its place next door to commercial radio, it has to have a differentiator, which is not just, oh, well, it's BBC local radio, we'll bring you all the reports. It really does need to know the colour of the doors in every street. It needs to know the people more, in my opinion. The people need to be able to be given a chance to be able to let everybody else know that they're there and they're useful in some ways or they're interested. A lot of this goes on, but I think it's too generic. But these are the things that it took this audience through the roof. And I stayed there for many years. I got a phone call one day from Radio 1. I was 21 years old, and it was from a guy called Chris Lyser at Radio 1. He said, I produce Mike Reed on Radio 1. I'm like, yeah. We're going to take the show around the country, and we're going to go and look at local music in different areas. Would you like to present the shows live on Radio 1 in Stoke from BBC Radio Stoke Studios? Yes. Yes. Oh, good. Well, look, we'll come and have a pre-meeting with you, and we'll show you how it works and what we're going to do and need, you know, blah, blah, blah. I thought, my God, you know, 21. And I think that's what made me the youngest DJ on Radio 1 ever live. And I had to do a week, and I loved it, albeit the music I was playing was typically nighttime radio, extremely alternative, almost John Peel. But I was enjoying it. And actually, what I enjoyed was the many links with local bands that I'd never seen when I was learning about that too. And then I didn't hear anything for years. So life continued at Radio Stoke, and that's fine amongst all the other things I was doing. And I was building effectively, a reputation. I was enjoying myself. I was starting to earn a bit of money. I bought my first house and stuff like that. And at 24, I remember that day very specifically. And there was a local guy who was an Elvis impersonator, real character, lived like Elvis in the 50s, And he said, hey, you know, is there any chance you could record us in that studio? Because Radio Soak had this fab studio right at the top to record bands. Amazing. I said, yeah, definitely. And I'm on air that evening at 6 o'clock. He was going to turn up with his transit van. We'd get all the gear out, his band members, and we'd record all through the night. I often did that. And as I'd finished my afternoon show, Marge on the reception, who'd been there for 50 years, she said, Bruno, yeah, Marge, call from Doreen Davis. I was in the studio, just, we used to have to do our own PRS and stuff there. It was a nightmare. Sorry? A call from Doreen Davis? Doreen Davis? Radio 1, Doreen Davis? I think so. She's calling from Broadcasting House in London. Yeah, put her through. Put her through. Bruno? Yes? Doreen Davis, Radio 1. We're wondering if you can come and see us, probably next week sometime or the week after. Oh, we'd just come and we'd like to come and talk to us. That'd be good. Would you look at your diary and would you let us know when you might want to come and join us in the next couple of... I will. Absolutely, yes. Okay, I'll come back to you. Wow. And I was sat there in the studio by myself. Most people had gone. And then there was another call from Marge. Bruno, it's Marjorie. Yeah, you've got somebody at the door. Strange Elvis Presley looking guy. Got a quiff and all that. What's going on? There's a white transit van on the double yellows outside and he's going to get booked. I thought, oh yeah, I'm recording. I'm going to be recording him all night long. Yeah, I'll come down. So four floors down and there he was. Hey, Bruno, how you doing, kids? All right, yeah. Yeah, I'm fine, mate. I'm all over the place. He said, what's up, lad? What's up? I said, I've just had a call from London. I think I've had the big call. What do you mean the big call? Yeah, Radio 1. Never. What? You going on radio? No. Stop there. Look, I'm a bit all over the place. I know we're supposed to be getting all the gear out, recording the band tonight. Could we do it another night? I'm just a bit distracted. But I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll take you and the lads to this Chinese restaurant right next door. We'll go and have some drinks in there. We'll have Chinese all night long. Well, I promise I will record you, but I just don't want to do it tonight. It had that much impact on me. And we went and had Chinese, too many wines, and we never did record, unfortunately, the band ever again, albeit we did see each other again. And I went down to Radio 1 a few weeks later. I was a bit worried about the way I was looking. You know when you try too hard when you're buying clothes and you end up buying nothing, and then in the last minute before they all close, you buy something which is, it'll do, and you'd probably spent far too much money. That was the excuse for buying it, because it must look good. Well, this oversized purple jacket that I ended up wearing is the one that I went to go and see Doreen Davis and the late, great Derek Chinnery in his office. And my dad drove me down there, and I was nervous. It's because it was something that I envisaged as a dream when I was 14, a teenager. I was nervous, and I got there, and I'm introduced. I went into Egerton House, past those guys with the suits, commissionaires, and taken up at a lift and onto the third floor. I'm seeing some very famous faces, and I'm pulled in by Doreen's secretary into Derek Chinnery's office, and I know these guys. I know what they look like, you know. And Derek said, Bruno, hi, pull a chair.
I think that's a form of public service that the BBC can be proud of.
But we had a chat, and they said, well, Mike Reed's going away. He does this Sunday programme. He's going away for 7 weeks doing whatever. And we'd like you to do that. How do you feel about that? And I said, oh, well, that'd be absolutely fantastic. Really, amazing. And they said, oh, okay, well, that's fine. Radio lovers will probably know there was a number of generals at Radio 1 in those days. And were you a Doreen boy, or were you a Johnny boy, or whatever it might be? Well, I was clearly a Doreen boy.
I wouldn't ever put a piece of music on any programme I ever did that people wouldn't want to go out and buy.
So I could see who was looking after me was Doreen. to make that very clear to myself very quickly. And I really, really worked hard, if not too hard, to try and get this so slick on equipment that was the other way around. I mean, we used to pull the faders down. You push your fader up for volume, not the other way around. Everything was the other way around. And I had to get used to all different networks coming in and how that worked. And my God, did I have a lot to learn. Because Stoke is, and even is still to this day, a pretty normal town with not a lot going on, to be fair, compared to a city like London.
Duran Duran and the Wild Boys at 5:15, and there's the wild adventures of Carol Hammond, you might have read in the paper, who plans to turn a railway signal box, disused for 20 years, into a two-bedroom home at Newbury in Berkshire, which is quite an adventurous feat, that, don't you think? Anyway, that's Duran Duran. Time for the birthday box, the very first birthday box.
There are lots of things I can remember, because there were many one-off events, which in anyone's life would be incredible in their memory forever. I met some incredible people. I got to be friends with some incredible people of all walks of life. But my first 2 months living in London was incredibly lonely. London is a very lonely place, if you don't know anybody. You know, a few people at Radio 1, they don't live in London. They live in Dorking. They live in wherever. They don't live in London. Very few. I remember I found this flat for about 2 or 3 weeks, which was horrible. And then this guy came along, and he was Status Quo's manager. Oh, yeah. He said, oh, we've got a flat in, you know, not far away from Hyde Park. You can have that. Really? Just have that. To tell us when you don't want it anymore. I said, it's very kind. So I went around to this. I mean, seriously, as you would imagine, Status Quo, very rock and roll flat. All sorts of memorabilia and guitars and signed this and black leather everywhere and a bar full of everything. And yeah, the way you would imagine it, that's the way it was. Easy when you're number one. And I stayed in this flat in a lovely part of town, but I didn't know anybody. Nobody talks to you in London. And I found that pretty tough. And in some respects, it was having a bit of an effect on me. And I started to drink a little bit more than I should have done. You know, because it helps your confidence, and at the same time you're in environments that where you want to meet people through having a drink and chat a bit about football or music or whatever it might be. So it was quite tough, and my journey was getting tougher because of that, not because of anything to do with Radio 1 or any pressure on the job, albeit there was a hell of a lot to learn. I found myself travelling a lot. All of a sudden I had an agent and a manager who had a big red limo, Michael Cohen. He said, you have to come with me. You know, I've got all the big names and I want you. You know, and I mean, it's like something you'd sort of, you know, see in a movie. And then the next minute I see him, you know, I'm literally driving around the country and in some cases being paid to fly to different parts of the world. But it was still far too early. It's a bit like the X Factor, which, by the way, is a phrase that came from Radio 1. And it was Doreen Davis who came up with that phrase. And she used it as early as my first few months, where she said, I think you've got the X Factor, which gives a great confidence builder. But only inside that tower of the BBC can you feel that good. And when you go into a studio and that kit is yours for you to be able to control and bring yourself together with this audience. Outside of that tower was this city of people that were sort of... I also felt that culturally I was inept. Because in Stoke it's one way, in London it's every way. But I found myself, you know, sort of getting in at 4 o'clock in the morning, whether I'd be out with a record plugger, whether I was even driving myself back from a gig in South Wales. You know, I was doing gigs literally within probably 12 weeks of getting to Radio 1. And there's a classic story of me actually going to Wales and driving myself. I suddenly realised that was not the right thing to do. You were simply too tired. But I'd driven to Wales and I'd bought myself a new 911 Porsche. You know, a few quid now. I got to Wales. And the next day, I'd been given a slot on a on Super Channel or something like that, a live video channel. Pat Sharp was on there, Gary Davis was on there, from St John's Wood Studios, 8 o'clock in the morning. So I'm in Wales until 1 o'clock in the morning on stage, got in my car, and then had to drive all the way back to London from Wales, then somehow get some sleep and be in a studio live at 8 o'clock that morning. As I'm coming from Wales, I stopped off around Swindon, and it was absolutely throwing down with rain. I mean, it was that bad. But I was really tired. I thought, I'm just going to have a nod. 7 o'clock the next morning, the traffic's coming past me. It's still raining really hard. Trucks. And I wake up, and I suddenly realise I was still on the hard shoulder near Swindon. I then realised that I should be in a TV studio in St John's Wood at 8 o'clock in the morning live to Europe. Oh my God, my God, my God, my God. I went to start the car flat because I'd had my heater on all night. I never made it. I was fired from the TV production company, and I thought, I've got to grow up here. I've got to change all of this. I've got to take the advice.
Thanks, Steve. Radio 1. It's all on compact disc from now until 6 in FM stereo.
The experiences did change me as a person. In fact, in some respects, I wish they'd changed me quicker. But like all of us, we grow up culturally as we are. We are influenced by our direct peers, our family, and the environment around us, where we come from. I wasn't somebody that went to university. In hindsight, I wished I had. You know, you've heard the phrase so many times, my university has been the university of life. And that is absolutely true. I mean, I've learned so much and achieved quite a lot. But it was a question of trying to work in a way that I was expected to work and manage myself in a way that I was expected to manage myself. And we're all different. You know, you've got Robbie Williams, for instance, as a Stoke boy. Well, look how different he is to Gary Barlow. He's a very successful guy. Forget that. I'm just talking about as a person, the way he approaches life. And then you've got somebody over here who approaches life completely differently. Yeah, I was more the Robbie than I was the Gary. Well, the Roadshow was big business, you know. It was quite incredible. It was a well-oiled machine, extremely well-established, and an event that people would look forward to around the British coast, and they should be. Radio 1 and its leverage was able to bring some amazing people to these beaches where there were immense crowds in some places. And not just on beaches. I mean, we did a gig. There was me, Gary Davis, a couple of other guys. We were flown into Haydock Park in helicopters on the bill. I think we got Duran Duran, you know, a few of the other big guys. 50,000 people turning up for a Radio 1 roadshow, effectively, with another 10,000 people stuck in traffic all the way back to Liverpool or somewhere, including my family, who never actually got to come and see the show. That was the life. You know, that was what you were doing, pretty normal stuff, really. I suppose the experience that kicked in gave me, you know, an advantage, I felt, in terms of live shows. You know, there were lots of guys at Radio 1 that were very good live. But undoubtedly, it made it easier for me. It would make it easier for me, for instance, when I could see there was a damp squid of a day, people were miserable, and just finding ways of actually getting them going. Well, like every organisation, it had an element of politics. I'm by nature not a political type. I'm more black and white. I just rather work it out, and I still am to this day. But the thing that became obvious is that you were in an exec's camp. We were a Johnny guy? Were you a Doreen guy? Were you a Stuart guy? Were you, where were you? That became obvious. It's not that we would go to war internally. It's very difficult to explain, but it wasn't as fluid and free and easy as probably it could have been. I knew exactly what I had to do on air. I knew exactly what was going on with the radio station, what it was planning. Really, really wanted to be involved. But there were some people, who I won't name, at Radio 1, where intelligibly we were a million miles apart. And when I say intelligibly, I mean in all areas of life, life's perception. For me, there are all sorts of intelligence. I felt as if there were some barriers there with certain individuals, on air and off air. And also, that kind of digs into your confidence a little bit.
Systems go, very definitely Donna Winter, because looking at the weather for tomorrow, we've got further wintry showers in Glasgow, and about the same actually for Belfast. It's something I always notice when reading out these weather forecasts.
I remember, you know, years previously when Peter Powell was the presenter in that slot, and he got it bang on. You know, Peter was probably the most comfortable person, I think, in that slot. And I remember even thinking, how did Peter do it? What was his approach and why? And I thought, yeah, now I get this now. And what I try to do is to kind of follow that line, but also try and bring a bit of comedy in there. I mean, Twisted Lyrics is something that I'd sort of established, which became very, very popular. And every day I was opening mail, and I couldn't wait to sort of hear the track, hear the Twisted Lyric. Every day I would have between one and two post office sacks full of mail. Not dissimilar from what you'd see on Going Live and Saturday Superstore when they'd show these big bags of mail. It was exactly the same at Radio 1. The common denominator is that I would have said that 85% of this mail was from females. They were fans. They were either a Duran fan, a Wham fan, a-ha, Bross. You sort of engineered conversations, if you like, with the audience in terms of, well, who is best? I mean, the new single from Bross is out this week, seems to go in really well, but just creating a bit of competition between the bands, and it was amazing how many people would write in and say, no, but Bross are this, and no, but, you know, Simon Le Bon's this, and, you know, it really was girls, guys in the bedroom doing their homework. And that's exactly the brief I got from Doreen Davis, and she was absolutely right. That was the audience, really. Yeah, the feedback was generally very good, but I think it came from my producer. I mean, Martin Cox particularly was incredibly responsive and helpful. He was one of the producers I had. It just had a knack of being able to understand me and what would, you know, it's about empowering me, isn't it, to do what we all think is right rather than just work as a solo. We had a lot of laughs together. We were friends. It worked. We understood each other. And in terms of the higher management, generally, you know, you would get a letter every now and then. I received some unexpected letters from management when it came to the figures. You know, the figures were really good, top 40. So the what they call the RIs, I had a record RI for the top 40. That's the reaction index, which was at 97, which I think was at first, which basically means that 97 out of 100 people thought it was excellent. I can't actually remember when I did my first chart show. And I can't remember the circumstances, in that I probably stood in.
It's 5 o'clock, and this is where we welcome listeners on FM stereo to National Radio 1. We'll be together right through until midnight in glorious stereo, but now it's time for this is Bruno Brooks with the UK Top 40, the most important stereo countdown of the best-selling singles in Great Britain. Compiled for the BBC by Gallup and used exclusively by Radio 1, Top of the Pops and the British record industry. There's a new entry at
number 40,
Susie and the Banshees.
All I remember was is that the chart show for me was a bit like a bug in a rug. It was so natural for me because I think that when you're introducing a piece of music to anybody in any scenario, even at home, when somebody comes around, oh, have you heard that? Check this out. I love it. Check this out. Right? It needs that passion to introduce it on a greater scale. Believe me, I mean, some of the top 40 presenters over the years are my absolute heroes. Tony Blackburn, what a legend.
This is the Top 40 as compiled for the BBC by the British Market Research Bureau. This week we've lost the Jets. Cool and the Gang.
But the one thing I was going to do was just give it that sense of energy. That number one is the destination. And a destination needs an interesting ride. And there needs to be a sense of excitement as you get closer to the destination. And the interesting thing is here is that we don't know what's actually in the destination, because it might be very different from what was there last week. And so my job, I believe, was to create that sense of excitement all along the way. Interestingly, I was watching The King's Speech on television last night. I haven't actually seen this film before, but heard lots about it. And the whole film was really all about his almost a disability, in that he couldn't speak the way that he wanted to. And he had this speech therapist all the way through the movie, and he grew very close with this guy. And some of the things that were revealed towards the end of the movie is techniques in which it would help him to actually make that amazing speech, which he did in the end.
I'm not here to discuss personal matters.
Well, why are you here then?
Because I bloody well stammer!
And I couldn't believe what I was seeing, because he'd written down the words and he was using a kind of an extra language over and above each word, which were lines that would point in a certain direction. Honestly, I was shocked, because I did exactly the same when I wrote my links at Radio 1. Honestly, I had absolutely no idea. It was just something I felt that I should do. A bit like reading another, in a reading language, that you're looking at different languages, you're looking for different things for the intonation. And that's what I did. Almost over every single word and every single link, I had my own language to tell me, like reading music, where I'm going with that word. And it took a while to try and perfect, actually. But I felt that after 1 or 2 years, I really had. And it created a sense of energy and timing. I loved it. I felt it was truly me. It was the way I wanted to express myself. And it's the way I wanted to sell these tracks and this chart. And we're getting closer. It's closer. It's nearly there. Coming up next. Who will be? Music was very expensive then. Probably at that time, you know, a CD or a mini CD was £3.50.
Rage Against the Machine, Killing in the Name, is in at
number 27.
First of all, I thought that was an amazing track, and I still do. I often hear it and chuckle, and that's a very, very well produced track. Interestingly, I play the edited version in the car. And not the long version, which found its way live during a Top 40. But I do remember the day when I played it. You know, often I get sent articles, that, and it's written about even to this day, you know, where the Radio 1 DJ in England plays this and da-da-da, and wasn't that amazing? We never thought we'd hear that on radio, but he played it, what a hero. No, I'm no hero. And probably could have lost my job. But you see, this is what typically me. Once I got that track on live on the Top 40, what I'd do then is I'd switch the speakers off and I'd work out my next link. Then the flashing white light in the studio. I thought, oh, somebody's trying to get hold of me. What I didn't realise, at Reception and Broadcasting House, who transfer the calls over to Egton House, there were hundreds of calls coming through, complaints that I was playing this track. I had absolutely no idea, because I didn't even know it was that version of the track. So, but when I'd finished the show, but we went round to the pub, I remember it, and just didn't say anything, just numb. I can't believe I've just done that. But people found it hilarious.
All these pretty people here dancing to Numero Uno and, of course, Starlight. Here's a countdown now from 40 to 31.
Every Radio 1 DJ, I think, would want to do Top of the Pops in its day. It was the televisual version of Radio 1. And as a Radio 1 DJ, it was an honour to present that show as many times as I did. I always remember the first show. I was so nervous. And it was live. What I could never understand is why the producers of Top of the Pops, when choosing presenters, couldn't have probably considered that by bringing in their newest presenter, had only been there a few weeks, and putting him straight into a live Top of the Pops, whether that might be a bit unfair or even risky. I'd never experienced what they call a cold sweat until the day I did Top of the Pops live with DLT. I was absolutely freezing cold, but I was sweating buckets in this kind of grey jacket and trousers. You know, it just looked so wrong for the programme. And again, there was no one really styling me at all. There should have been. Maybe I should have invested in that at the time. But I was learning as I was going. Well, there's been much written about my private life. Whether it's accurate or not is a different story, and I wouldn't be the first to complain about that. Pressure. We read about it all the time. We see, you know, everyday people we love on television, whatever they do, that all have their problems. And, being in this industry undoubtedly brings pressure to your home life. There are many reasons why it does, and it's to be expected. Of course, the important thing is how do you deal with it? And remember, I'm a young man. You know, I had a massive responsibility at 24 at Radio 1. Very difficult to find support in your management, whether that be your closest ally and your partner, or in the management that you employ to look after your interests. It's not really their job to manage that. It's their, well, it should be, but it didn't seem to be. And often I used to record TV shows, Love at First Sight. I used to do five a day for 25, 30 a week, on top of everything else I was doing. You know, this is a lot of pressure. This is not normal stuff. You know, you do end up getting a bit tetchy, and on the other side, quite rightly, get a bit tetchy. And then it's just human behaviour, isn't it? You're tired, you're worn out, you're not giving enough back, you don't take me out enough, or something, whatever it is. It's pressure, and it's only to be expected. And there are lots of people in the public eye who work to that sort of schedule right now, and I applaud them to be able to manage that at home in the best possible way. But I'm sure they have their issues. It's a shame that certain periods of my life just became magnified, amplified the way they did in the wrong way, because it doesn't reflect me really as the way I am. It's just, as I was saying earlier on, a lot of pressure on both sides, you know, to be fair. And that was where I was my biggest enemy. And if I was to sort of start again, I wouldn't put myself under too much pressure, and I'd be much more considered in how I went about things. Well, there was a reason why I was asked to do the early breakfast show. This, whether it was right or wrong, or it was a way of putting me on at 4 o'clock in the morning to get rid of me, I don't know. But the reason was that there was a struggle with Capital at the time at breakfast, and they were winning certainly the London ratings war. And Johnny Beeling said, look, we would like to do the early breakfast show. And when I was asked, and I remember it vividly, I thought, oh, really? That means I'm getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning, and I'm doing this. God, this is going to be a killer. It will just be a killer. So I said, okay, fine, I'll do the early breakfast show. And the reason was because we think that you'll build an audience which will then flow into the beginning of the breakfast show at 6, and that's where the ratings kick off for breakfast. We want to get breakfast as strong as we possibly can versus our commercial partners. Well, that bit of strategy made absolute sense, and that's the reason why I said, yes, I'll do this, I get it. And I loved it, but I tell you, it wore me out. I see some pictures sometimes of the period of time when I was doing that show. I looked really rough. It was killing me.
Radio 1 has got to be a forward-looking radio station, and if I'm known for anything, it's for taking new ideas forward, taking new talent forward, and I think that's something we can...
I was very, very disappointed in the exit and the way that it was done. When Matthew came down and said, that's it, we don't want you to do any more. And I remember I was living in Ireland at the time, and I went to Heathrow Airport, caught the plane over there. But before I went to see him in the office and I said, look, Matthew, I said, I'm really shocked about this. I don't understand. I really don't understand why. It's not about listeners. You record audiences at that time of the day. What is it? What's wrong? He said, look, that's the way it is. We've got different plans going forward and so on. I said, and he told me that he was going to Liverpool University and he was making a speech there to the media students. I said, okay. Well, he said, well, you're not going to mention anything about this, are you? We need to do a proper press release and I need to talk to my manager and my agent. He said, yeah, no, absolutely. And so anyway, I got to Heathrow, I got on the plane, I was picked up by Margaret, I was taken to the house, and as I was going towards the house, I saw a load of press outside my gates. This is an island, Southern Ireland. And what had happened is that he'd mentioned it. He got to Liverpool, he was on an early train, 6 o'clock, I believe, and I remember this vividly. And he clearly mentioned something, and it got out. And in that very short space of time, all of these journos were there, and they're all from the papers we know. And they wanted me to make comment, and I was shocked that they knew. It wasn't what we agreed. And then they wouldn't leave me alone all day, so with various interviews and this, that, and everything else, and so on. But it did come as a bit of a shock, and I didn't think at that time I deserved it. I didn't quite understand what their strategy was going forward. It would have been nice to have just understood and had some notice. I didn't think it was the right way, considering the service I'd given to the channel. I'm not bitter about it. I'm just literally reflecting. I can reflect in a way that I've since moved on, and 20 years later I employ people now. I wouldn't do that to one of my people. So that was a shame. It was a shame that it was a parting in that way. Well, I've always been somebody that thinks about next, even when next hasn't arrived. Just because I get excited about where media, radio is moving, I'm still like that to this day. And that's what it's that thought process that has created a media. But at that time, I took about 2, 3, 4 weeks to try and understand what it meant. But in my home in England, I decided that because technology was moving forward the way it was, to come up with this whole idea of a radio show that would come from my house live. This was right at the beginning of ISDN. In fact, I don't think it was called ISDN. And I was determined that I would put this fantastic studio in my house in at the Mill House and bring in specialists to connect me to other radio stations. The problem is I didn't have the other radio stations. I hadn't worked that bit out. So then I went on a crusade to offer a format where I could work live and sound as if it was coming from these radio stations, which turned out to be Leeds and Metro. And Bruno the Mill House basically went to a very large number of big commercial radio stations. And it worked, you know, and it worked commercially. And that was really the start in terms of me thinking, having a different vision about radio and where it was going. And then, of course, not long afterwards, I launched Storm Live, which was the first radio station per se on the internet with live presenters. They were celebrity. Rick Blacksell was my head of content. I remember doing photo calls in the house. You know, the Storm Live was worth 30 million quid. All of a sudden, and you know, from nothing in 18 months, you know, again embracing technology and finding new audiences, and amazingly, we were doing extremely well in selling advertising in Storm Life. People probably don't know that we had amazing sponsors like, you know, the Sun newspaper at the time. The birth of eMedia came out of Storm Digital. Effectively, it was a transition. I just felt that a lot of these big brands on the high street were not getting, and there was never a sense of that they had a heartbeat or a personality other than the usual branded stuff you would see in these stores. You know, I think that, you know, more and more there is a need for communications to be outside of the sell zone. People just want information so they can make their own mind up. And I personally think that the sales, the ads in radio, went on far too long. I still hear them now, and I think, you know what, you're doing yourself no favours. You're trying to get me to fall for something. Just communicate with me. It is getting better. I felt that it was all missing from retail. First of all, I used to walk into retail stores, I'm talking about big brands now, and hear music with no distinction whatsoever, no reason, and probably not even licensed in some cases. And we all know music is licensed in different ways now. But it wasn't saying anything for the brand and the personality, the heartbeat of that brand. And there is an amazing opportunity for the brand to be able to communicate to millions of customers across a retail estate. Why is this not happening? So that was the reason why I launched something called Impulse Live. And I approached News International and I said, look, here's a great opportunity to get into hundreds, if not thousands, of convenience stores where they sell your newspapers. And then I went to Nestle and I went to Cadbury's, et cetera, et cetera. I said, this is where they sell your chocolate. Doesn't it make sense that we create a radio station in these stores and we offer it free? I'm supported by you, these brands, and in turn I'm supporting the sales of your product. And I thought, yeah, this is a great idea. So very quickly I took it from sort of 400 stores to 4,000 stores. Superdrug Live, bringing you that Superdrug feeling. To be honest, I think I got that from my dad. He was clearly entrepreneurial at his level, and there's a lot I picked up from him. But I've always been a go-getter. I've always liked to try and move things on a little bit. They've got to be commercial, of course. Of course they have, and they don't always work. I'm thinking out now to, you know, to 2021, where I'm going with this, some of the things that I think that can be commercialised. I was in a hotel in London having an evening meeting. These guys had come down from Lancashire, and I sort of stepped away from the meeting a couple of times. It was in the Waldorf Hotel in the front foyer, and this commissionaire, if that's what you want to call him, and his suit and his cap came over and he said, "You all right, sir?" I said, "Yeah, fine." I went back and I sat down to rejoin the meeting, and then got up again and started walking. He said, "We do have a doctor in the house, sir. If you're not feeling very well." I said, "No, I'm absolutely fine. I'm just got to go out and get a bit of fresh air." He said, "Okay." Anyway, cut a long story short, you know, 15 minutes later, an ambulance had arrived from Guy's. And literally within a minute, a bike was there, gave me his greens, sat me down. Very good. I mean, you tell you what, these guys are amazing. And they're absolutely amazing, these response teams and how they deal with it and whatever. Kept me really, really calm. Next minute, I'm at the St. Guy's Hospital across the way. The next minute, all my clothes are off. I didn't even know they did it. I mean, it's so organised. There must have been 8-10 people outside of the ambulance. And the surgeon, they obviously recognised that I had a heart attack. The surgeon that they wanted to use had now made his way home to Surrey, but he's going to turn back. And it was all happening so quickly. The next minute, I'm taken up into this theatre, which cost millions. Outside of a scenario like that, and even thinking that it could happen to yourself, you probably couldn't imagine anything worse. You don't understand what it's going to feel like. You don't understand what the response is to everybody, how they respond to it, family, friends, what effect it has on your work. And after that, I did have a slightly different outlook on how I conduct my life. Probably not so much drink, late nights, hard work. I just make work for myself sometimes. I get bored quickly and I have to be doing something on the go. I'm still like that now. I have to admit it. I am. Yeah, well, presenter training was something else. I'd sort of recognised that there was a shortage of presenters. There was also, as commercial radio was growing, smaller stations were being formed. And it was effectively the perfect starting point for presenters, but they must have some experience. You know, they can't just walk into a small radio station and say, "I can do that," because you can't. You've got to have some training. And so, yeah, I created the Radio and Television School, and some very, very interesting people came through that school who will remain nameless. Some famous people, people that you make contact with every day on television and on radio. and at a national level, and I'm very proud of that. I really am. But also in sport, it wasn't just sort of, you know, presentation as we know it. Most of the jockeys that you see now on TV as commentators all came through the Radio and Television School, and were funded by the organisation that helps the further development of jockeys. My management career, I mean, I manage people from people like Luke Goss to Rick Blaxell himself. I mean, Rick was the only person I think we know that had two positions in television as an executive producer, two different television companies at the same time. I negotiated quite a number of deals for Rick, and you know, Rick's a very, very creative producer. But yeah, managing Chris Moyles, for instance, you know, I managed Chris for a number of years, and you know, helped him, I hope, on that early journey.
Up five places to 24, I'm not going to let you, that's Colonel Abrams. 17 minutes to 6 on Radio 1. Let's look at 29 to 21.
Well, the future is I'd like to be here for a few more years. I don't look after myself as much as I should do, albeit I eat very well. I'm a food fanatic, a health food fanatic now, and I find the whole subject very interesting. I still think I work too hard. I still think I push too hard. It's because I'm just passionate about what I do. I'm obviously more mature now, let's say. I've learned a lot. There's still a lot I've got to learn. Generally, I'm very happy. I just want to stay lucky. I think I'd like to be remembered as the guy that tried hard.